Hello and welcome to Wayward Children, the podcast where we discuss Jewish myth, magic, monsters, and the stories we tell. I am the dust that flows through the air on a windy day outside a cemetery, John Baltusberger.
And I am Jack Zients, the shovel full of dirt landing on your coffin.
Friends, today I am tired. I am so tired. I have four different writing deadlines that I have to finish before a Thursday, which is in 3 days now. One of those deadlines is a book that I still need to finish 25% of. I have workshop stuff I gotta finish before I head to Portland for BizarroCon. I am so stressed out that my tuchus is just clenched. Like, I could make diamonds in there right now. So I say all this to say I decided I'm not saying anything tonight. Instead, I am going to hand it over to Jack here. And we're just gonna go and see where Jack takes us.
Friends, this is John's way of saying enjoy. That I talk too much, and John's just aiding and abetting me talking too much. So what's going on here, everybody, is I gave a talk in Michigan, where I live, at the Michigan LMUD. LMUD, if you don't know what it is a national organization. It's a Jewish day of learning. There probably is one near you. You know, depending on exactly where you live, there's lots of them all over the place. John is shaking his head. So,
out in Texas, baby.
there should be. There should be. You should ask yourself how come there isn't and make that happen. But you have other projects. But anyway, in Michigan, where I am, it's about five or six hours long with about five or six different speakers going on in parallel. It's like 40 different talks. It's absolutely amazing. This is my second year doing it. And this year, I gave a talk called Rolling to Jerusalem, Jewish Legends About Death and What Comes After, because there's this weird thing in Judaism. So I grew up in liberal Judaism. This is 100% true in liberal Judaism. From the people I talk to in traditional Judaism, particularly modern Orthodox, this is true in modern Orthodox a lot too, which is Jews don't really like to talk about death very much. And we certainly don't like to talk about what happens after death very much. And it's kind of understandable because, at least in the United States, we live in the shadow of a dominant religion, Christianity. And that's kind of all Christianity ever talks about. Like, it's all oriented to what happens later. And so, you know, we just kind of Jews take their own thing. But the truth of the matter is Judaism has a lot to say about what happens after we die. It's just that in true Jewish form, and like, I hear me say this all the time, we're so good at commentary and we're terrible at taxonomy, right? And what I mean by that is Jews have talked and argued about what happens after we die as long as there have been Jews, all the way back to when we were Israelites and talking the Torah. But it's not like there's a uniform consensus in the details. There's a general sense that something happens, and no spoilers, I'll talk about it during the talk. But like, what is really going on, like, is argued back and forth. And all the lore, there is so much great lore. Some of my favorite bits of Jewish lore revolve around what happens after we die, or the process of what after we die. So anyway, I'm going to shush because I'm going to be talking a lot now. What you're about to hear, after I gave the talk, I went home and re-recorded it at home. I didn't even try to record it at the thing. It was just too chaotic. So this is kind of me recording it at home. Now, I have slides. And so when you're listening to the podcast, you're not going to see the slides. You're not missing anything. You know, they're slides. But if anybody wants to see them, on my YouTube page, go to YouTube and Google Jewish Monster Hunting. You'll find
We'll link it in the show notes.
Yeah, we'll link it in the show notes. You'll see the slides. And if you shoot me an email or hit me up on Twitter, I'm happy to send you the slides if you want to see them. But you're not missing a lot. So anyway, John, with all of that said, let's do this.
Roll tape.
Roll tape. Hey everybody, this is Jack Zients, known on the internet as Adnei Sada. I have a blog called jewishmonsterhunting.com, and I tweet on Twitter and Blue Sky, and with my buddy the horror writer John Baltzberger, I am co-host of the podcast Wayward Children: Jewish Monsters, Magic, and the Stories We Tell. This is a talk called Rolling to Jerusalem: Jewish Legends About Death and What Comes After. It is a redo of the talk I gave at LeMood, Michigan last weekend. It was a great event. If you're local to Michigan, you should come next year. And if you're not, find out if there's a LeMood in your area. Really, really, really great event. Lots of great Jewish speakers. So anyway, let's get going. To talk about death, I need to set a couple of bullet points, a couple of context points for us before we kind of really get into the details. The first thing I want to say is that this is intended as a bit of a lighthearted talk to kind of introduce everyone to some of the more picturesque elements of Jewish death lore. That said, death is not a lighthearted topic. At no point do I want to make it seem that way. I lost my father earlier this year. He would have hated this talk. He hates anything that has to do with Jewish monsters, magic, and lore. And that's okay. But I hope that everyone listening to this, you know, when they're hearing me talk about this, don't try to place your beliefs, what your rabbi says, what you believe, against what's going on in the talk. I'm trying to talk about the last 3,000 years of Jewish ideas, Jewish history, and Jewish lore. I'm not telling anybody what they should believe. I'm not telling anyone what they shouldn't believe. I'm telling you what Jews have believed. And because of that, I'm going to use the term traditional Judaism as a bit of a hand-wavy dodge. Some of the lore that I'm talking about is 3,000 years old. Some of it is very current. It's going to come from different time periods and different groups. So if I'm saying something that doesn't align with your current worldview, assume I meant some other group of Jews that came before you. So it's also important there to understand that we live in a very rational time. A lot of this lore doesn't fit within our worldview because of it isn't aligned with our current view of rationality. And when I say that, I don't just mean liberal Jews, Reform, conservative, and the other liberal movements. Lots of the what I might call the traditional Jewish world, Orthodoxy, Hasidism, there's an awful lot of rationality in there too, particularly in a lot of the Orthodox communities. I'm a liberal Jew, grew up conservative, and currently in part of a Reform community. So for me, the traditional world is a little bit of an other, even though I spend a lot of time with those communities. A lot of what I'm about to talk about will be different, even for members of those communities, particularly the Orthodox community. So anyway, enough of the preamble. The bottom line is death is a touchy subject, so handle with care. Okay? So let's move in. So I kind of structured this talk around a set of interesting questions, questions that people have asked me, questions that come up whenever death comes up. One of those questions, and it's a great anchor point, is to ask, where did the mourner's kaddish come from? Yit gadal, v'yit kadash, shemei rabba, gloried and sanctified be God's great name. Other than Shema, the mourner's kaddish is probably the most recognizable of Jewish prayers. Whether you are a Jew who davens three times a day and therefore says the kaddish every day, or whether you're somebody who has never set foot in a synagogue but may have been at a cemetery and heard it recited graveside, the mourner's kaddish is iconic. But where did it come from? How did this prayer that never mentions death, doesn't paint a particular picture of what happens before or after we die, it's simply a statement of faith and a statement of awe around God. How did this particular prayer become associated with death, such that it should be said by children for their parents when they die? The short answer is we don't know. Our rabbis have not left us a clear answer to that question. But as is always the case in when we talk about anything Jewish, you know, there's a story. There's a story. So let's tell that story, or at least part of it. So the story is a story of Rabbi Akiva. And by the way, it gets associated with other rabbis. There's a lot of different versions. The one I'm citing now comes from Mahor Vitri, 11th century. But there's dozens of other variations on this story. But the tale is of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva, this is Rabbi Akiva, is a Talmudic rabbi. 2,000 years ago, he is walking in a cemetery by the side of a road, and he comes across a man who is naked, and he is burnt black. He is described as black as coal. This is not a description of him racially. This is a description of him physically. He has been burnt, charred black. He seems to be alive and is running under a load of wood. And Rabbi Akiva orders him to stop and asks why he's doing such hard work in the middle of the night. And he answers, I have been set to this task. Don't interrupt me. You're going to get me in trouble. And the rabbi can't, Rabbi Akiva can't handle that. He has to stop. No, you have to explain what's going on. And the man explains that he was a sinner who had died. He was in Gehenna. I'll explain Gehenna in a minute, but he's gone to Gehenna for punishment. And this is the task he's been set to. And Rabbi Akiva asks him, is there anything that I can do to help you? It's terrible that you're in this state. No, I deserve it. I was a terrible person when I was alive. Well, there has to be some way I can help you. And the man says, I have heard from my masters that if there was any merit to be found for me in the human world, then maybe I would be set free from Gehenna early. And they said that one kind of merit would be if I had a son, and if that son could say the Shema, who could help lead a service, just, you know, to say the Amida, then that might accrue some merit. But I have no such son. The Rabbi Akiva says, but do you have a son? Well, I have a son, but, you know, he is with my wife, and my wife is as terrible as I was, and we never raised our child to know Hebrew or to be able to say the prayers. It's impossible. Rabbi Akiva says, you must tell me, where would I find your wife and son? And so the man says, there's a town, and gives him directions to the town, and Rabbi Akiva was off like a shot. And when he got to the town, everybody in the town knew who this man was, and they all hated him. He was a terrible person. No one in the town thought he had a single redeeming feature. When Rabbi Akiva brought up his wife, she was just as bad as him. The two of them were a pair. And when they mentioned the son, nobody had even seen the son. He was not part of the community. No idea. But they could tell Rabbi Akiva where this person lived, where the boy lived. And so Rabbi Akiva goes off. And I'll cut the story short, but as the story goes, he finds the wife, he finds the son, he teaches the son Hebrew enough, he teaches him how to say the prayers, he brings him to the synagogue, much to everybody's shock when this ragged boy who everybody had dismissed shows up in synagogue with Rabbi Akiva and stands up and hesitantly leads the service, at least enough. He said the Shema, said the Amida in front of everybody, and said the Kaddish. And he said the Kaddish. And the Kaddish was his way of showing that he had learned and showing that he had followed in the tradition. One of the things about Judaism is we can accrue merit for our parents, but our parents cannot accrue merit for us. My dad was a great guy before he passed away. None of that helps me. None of the things my father gave to charity, he was part of a synagogue, he was a great help to his community. I get no credit for that. That was my father's work, nor should I. But when I learn and study and pray and teach, that my father gets credit. He accrues merit for that because he raised a son or a daughter, in my case, a son, who would be able to do that. And that became that idea of merit leading to helping the parent out is part of what motivated the story and part of how this story became associated with the mourner's cottage, that we, the things that we do in our life both benefit us, but they all also benefit our parents where we came from. So that is one explanation for where the idea of the mourner's cottage comes from. But it opens a whole ton of problems or of questions, right? So who is this dead guy? Like, what do we mean there's a dead guy running around? And what is Gehenna? Like, what do Jews believe happened after death? This story kind of points and cracks open this whole other world. So let's go. Let's jump into it. So the first place we want to start is Sheol, the netherworld. In Israelite religion, this is pre-temple, pre-rabbi. This is the time of the Torah, and Sheol is referenced multiple times in the Torah. There's this idea of a netherworld. One way to think about it is that the biblical conception of death says that there's a diminishing of energy, of nefesh, but not complete annihilation. What does that mean? It means that you're a shadow, a shade, a memory. For people who've seen the Harry Potter movies or read the books, it's like the paintings in the movies or the paintings on the wall of Hogwarts, right? You can talk to it. It kind of knows who it used to be, but it's not that person anymore. It's just a painting of the person. And that's the idea. And it's referenced multiple times in Psalms, in Genesis. In Genesis, Jacob specifically talks about going down Sheol because he was so upset about his son Joseph dying that he will go down mourning. And this is the idea that Sheol is filled with these ghosts or shades. And what's important about that is, just like the Harry Potter paintings, right, these shades, they're us, but they're not really fully us, but they're there and they can be talked to and they can be communicated with, which leads to this whole idea in Jewish thought about necromancy, about speaking to the dead. It's all over the Torah and the Talmud and Jewish writings. It's usually cast in this idea that necromancy works, but it's a bad idea. You're not supposed to do it. It's what those other people on the other side of the hill do. Don't do that. And yet, it works and it gets done. And it's often the case that, particularly later, that rabbis, when they do it, they often find loopholes and ways to justify why it's really okay when they do it. But just starting with Torah, it's definitely considered a bad thing. There are specific people who can speak to the dead to get information. They're called Balat Ov. They're people who conjure up the dead to get information. The most famous example of this in Tanakh is the story of the Witch of Endor, which we'll get to in a second. But before we jump into that, I want to talk about one of my favorite examples of speaking to the dead in Torah and later, which is called Teraphim. Teraphim are a divination through talking heads. The heads represent the dead. They are like little household idols in the Torah, but they take on deeper meaning later on. And the classic example of Teraphim is in Genesis 31, when Jacob has gone to get Rachel, who he is going to marry her, and she wants to marry him, and he steals her away. And Rachel stole her father's household idols as part of this. And why did she steal them? Because the rabbis have a different answer, but the original answer was because if he had had the teraphim, he could have asked where Jacob had taken Rachel and gone off to catch up with them, not what he had wanted. The lots of rabbinic discussion about how Rachel was very clever about stealing the teraphim. The more popular story version of this is that she stole the household idols because she was a good monotheist worshiper of God, and they were idols and terrible to be destroyed. It's a good story, except that, you know, she wasn't really part of the tribe yet, right? She hadn't really been introduced to God in that way yet. That's a little iffy. It's really much more about cutting off an information source that she didn't want her father to have. Okay. So now the other great story in Genesis, in Tanakh, is the Witch of Endor. You'll notice on the slide, folks who are seeing the slide in front of them, I don't write the Witch of Endor. I write the Ghost Diviner of Endor, because that's what the Balat Ov means. Someone who can talk to ghosts to get information. I've always hated the term Witch of Endor. Excuse me. Witch of Endor. It is a insulting, derogatory term, and unnecessarily so. It brings on all sorts of negative connotations, and it's misogynistic, right? You know, it's very gender specific in a way that Balat Ov didn't necessarily need to be. So I'd much rather use the term Ghost Diviner of Endor. It's much more accurate. In the story of the Ghost Diviner of Endor, Saul, who was the king, is in a really bad way. It's very clear that God no longer favors him or supports his rule, and he needs to get information. The problem is, the normal ways of getting information through the high priests is not working. He has been cut off from any information about God. There's a whole other thing, the set of things we could talk about how Israelite king could talk to the high priest, and the high priest could do divination to get information, but that's all been cut off. And Saul, in trying to make God happy, has created a set of laws that have banished a lot of foreign magic practices, and specifically the Balat Ov, from the kingdom. And so he has a problem. Where is he going to get his information? Well, he tells his servants, go find me a Balat Ov. They're like, hey, you kicked them all out. He's like, there's got to be one left. Go find it for me. Go find her for me. They do. And when the woman finds out that it's Saul the king, she's terrified. She thinks she's being trapped. He reassures her that, no, it's okay. Yeah, he banished her, but banished people like her, but he really needs her help. And then he has her summon. He has her summon Samuel the prophet, and it works. She is able to do that. She's able to bring Samuel from. He is able to bring Samuel from Sheol. By the way, it's not so easy to give a talk when I'm used to talking in front of bunches of people, and I'm all alone in my basement down here. So anyway, so she brings up the spirit of Samuel, and Samuel is like, listen, you already know the answer. There's no reason, it was wrong of you to summon me. God is already angry at you. This isn't making it better. Your rule is over. You're done. Samuel goes away. Saul collapses. And as always in the Jewish tradition, you know, they ate. They had food. That made it a little bit better. So anyway, to wrap this up, right, this tradition of necromancy goes really, really deep in the Jewish psyche, in the Jewish lore. But again, it's usually tinged with this. This is illicit. It works, but it's an illicit action. You're supposed to be getting your information directly from God, not through these other sources. But over the years, over the centuries, all sorts of loopholes and other ways around it have been developed. And one of my favorites of these is the Schwarze Kasse, which is Yiddish for black weddings. By the way, my Yiddish pronunciation is terrible, so anybody who speaks Yiddish, please forgive me. The idea of a black wedding is absolutely necromancy, but a slightly, slightly different kind that made it much more palatable in Jewish practice. And I also want to point out, not only is it more palatable, but it's still being done. The photograph that's on the slide, if you're looking at the slides, has a photograph of Mount Olive in Jerusalem in Israel from 1903. It's part of the Library of Congress collection. And it has a large group of Jews gathered in a cemetery with a black chuppah. This is 1903. And they're carrying on a tradition that's centuries old. So what are they doing? They're trying to stop a plague. The idea of black weddings comes from cholera, from bubonic plague. You reach a point in the community where a community becomes desperate that there is nothing left they can do. They've done everything that their doctors have said. They've done everything that the rabbis can do. The rabbis have prayed. There's nothing left, and they're really worried that the entire community will die from this plague. So they go and find two marginal members of the community, a man and a woman, who are young, who are unmarried, and have no marriage prospects. Maybe they're orphans. Maybe they're ill, or they have a handicap. Maybe they have some kind of maybe they're addicted to alcohol, whatever. They're not someone that a yenta, a matchmaker, would try to match up. They've got nothing. They've got no marriage prospects whatsoever, and probably no other prospects either. So the community goes to them and picks these two out and says, hey, would you marry? We're going to fix you up with someone to marry. This is probably your only shot at getting married. We're going to fix you up with somebody. We're going to marry you in a graveyard under a black chuppah. The wedding's real. It's 100% legit. You will be married. And for doing this, the congregation is going to give you gifts, lots of gifts. Whatever we can afford, you're going to get showered with wedding presents to help you start a life and maybe get you out of whatever problem set that you've got. Maybe this will be enough to help you kind of really get going. And this happens. There's a long documented history of these black weddings. And so what's the point? Why is the congregation doing this? They're doing this as a way to deliver a message to the dead in the graveyard who still linger. And we're going to talk about ghosts in a little bit. The dead who still linger, the dead of the rabbis, of their parents, of their grandparents, of the great sages and great people of the town, who are now in another place, who can now whisper in the angels' ears, whisper in God's ears, and plead on behalf of the community that maybe they can get the message through, that the community is doing all they can, that they're pious, that they pray, that they're doing all they can. They need just a bit more help to help them escape this terrible, terrible plague. It's necromancy, right? It's exactly the same as teraphim, exactly the same as the blood oath. The only difference is you're not asking for information. There's no expectation of a voice coming back and saying, hey, yeah, we know we got the message, we passed it on. Like, they're not expecting that. But what they're hoping is that message is going to get delivered from the holy dead in the graveyard to God's ears, because the congregation is doing their best. They're doing whatever they can. And hey, look at this mitzvah. They just helped these two sad sacks, hopefully, you know, press reset and restart their life. Total, total necromancy, just of a different flavor. Like I said, Jews tend to find loopholes. So let's move on a little bit. Sha'ol was kind of Torah. I mentioned Gehenna. Gehenna is actually Greek, and Hebrew is Gehenim, but Gehenna is a much more common term. Gehenna is what Sha'ol evolved into by the Talmudic period and certainly through the Middle Ages into early modern period. It was a belief of a place of temporary punishment, usually underground. There's some discussions of it being up in the mountains, but it's typically underground. It's the opposite of Gan Eden, that there's this idea in Judaism, we'll talk about in a minute, of Olam Haba, the place, the world to come, where there's a Gan Eden, a Garden of Eden waiting for us. But first, Gehenna gets us, right? And it's important to note here that Gehenna is not, it's sort of similar to Christian views of hell in certain ways. Like, there's demons, there's punishment, though the demons are very different. You know, punishment is punishment. But number one is it's very temporary, right? You're only there at most for 12 months. Like, and you're there to purify yourself. It's much more like being purified in a crucible than it is like endless punishment. Secondly, it's kind of where the normal people end up. I don't know about you. I've led a pretty decent life, I think, but there are some things I've screwed up in my life. Not stuff that I'm going to talk about here on the podcast, but if we go out for coffee, I can tell you about two or three moments in my life where, yeah, I probably earned a trip through Gehenna for stuff that I did or didn't do in at least one case. This is why when we talk about Jewish mourning practice, Jewish mourning lasts for a year, but we typically stop mourning for our dead. I'll stop mourning for my father when he has been buried for 11 months, because we never want to imply that anyone in our family is so terrible that they would need to be there for the full 12 months. But again, maybe my father's in Gehenna right now, but I know that he's gonna go through. My father was a pretty good guy, even though I'm sure he had his moments too. Unlike the Christian version of hell, this is not where evil people go. If you can imagine somebody who is absolutely like the worst of the worst of the worst, that person may not get into Gehenna at all. You have to rate. You have to be okay. Just kind of a normal level of crappy to get into Gehenna. The really evil people don't make it through. There is no hope of them passing through and getting onto the world to come. As I said, it's underground. It's kind of where it is. It's kind of interesting. So one of the main gateways to it is right in Jerusalem, is the Valley of Hinnom, which had been a place of child sacrifice, or at least according to the rabbis, had been a place of child sacrifice, not by Jews or Israelites, but by other groups who lived there. So it was so terrible that it became an opening to Gehenna. Another place is in the wilderness. This is Korach. So if you know your story of Exodus, Korach led a rebellion against Moses, and God took Moses aside, and Korach and his followers were swallowed by a pit. Well, they, according to the rabbis, it was Gehenna. They went right to Gehenna. And then finally, there's another location in the sea. So that's Gehenna. And so we were talking about the charcoal man and his story. He considered himself a terrible person. But clearly, while he was terrible, he wasn't like evil terrible. He was just a normal jerk, doing the normal jerky things that people do. And he was in Gehenna, but he wasn't going to be there all that long. He was going to be there a month. But even that, Rabbi Akiva felt like he couldn't just let him go through that without Rabbi Akiva at least trying to find some way to ease his suffering. Okay? Now, one last thing I want to talk about here before we move on to our next question is the angel of death. So first of all, Judaism has about five, at least, angels of death. And we're not going to get to all of them in this talk, but I want to bring up one angel of death, because this angel, Duma, is very tightly associated with Gehenna. Duma is the angel of silence and death who looks over Gehenna. It is Duma's job to bring people from the grave into Gehenna. And someday when the world to come happens, it'll be Duma's job to report to God about everybody who has passed through Gehenna. So Duma, the angel of silence, Duma really means silence, but Duma, the angel of silence and death, is one of Judaism's angels of death. I'll note, this is not the angel of death that we think about during the Passover in the story of Exodus. God had to send a different angel for that. Duma was supposed to have been that angel. Part of Jewish lore is that there are guardian angels, particularly at the national level, but also at the individual level. And Duma had been the guardian angel of Egypt, and he loved the Egyptians so much that he couldn't honor God's instruction when it came time to kill the firstborn. And so God had him punished by assigning him the duty of overseeing death. Because he didn't bring death when God insisted, it was now his job to curate death and to be associated with death. Okay, so Mourner's Kaddish, moving on. Another big thing in Judaism around death is being buried in Jerusalem. And so this raises the question of why do Jews want to be buried in Jerusalem or have their death somehow associated with Jerusalem? So when I say associated, there's a lot of tradition, particularly in Ashkenazi Judaism, but it also shows up in Sephardic, of either moving to Jerusalem right before you die, having your casket shipped to Jerusalem to be buried on Mount Olive or another cemetery, or if that's not possible, being buried with a bag of soil from Jerusalem, dirt from Jerusalem. If you're watching the slides here, I've got a bag. This is not sure how old this is. I think from the 1950s, which is a bag that you would, you know, write away to Israel with money, and you'd get this dirt shipped back to you in this kind of bag. And this is from my personal collection. It's amazing what you can find on eBay these days. So at any rate, this is a very deep, deep need in Judaism, and it's still part of a burial tradition in a lot of more traditional communities. And so where did this happen? Like, where did this need to, or this longing to be buried in Jerusalem come from? Well, two places. So first of all, the Talmud does have an explanation. It's talking about community. You know, that's where Jews want to be. So that's where you want to be when you're buried. That Jerusalem is associated with atonement, that maybe by being buried in Jerusalem and by going through that effort to be buried in Jerusalem, that will bring merit to you. Remember, I was saying before, merit is important to help kind of mitigate your time in Gehenna. But yeah, but there's a deeper, while that's there, it's true, there's a deeper reason. And that is where the physical resurrection of the world is going to happen. So what the heck do I mean by physical resurrection? All right. So there's these two. I talked before really briefly about Olam Haba, the world to come. So let's kind of go back to that for a minute. So there's this idea in Jewish lore that a messianic age is coming, where a new Garden of Eden will be reinstated. That is supposed to be, you know, this is all, for most of us, it's expected to be after we die sometime in the future. Some people might happen to be there at the right time. But generally, the idea is sometime after you die, you will wake up here. There's two different ways of thinking about this in Judaism. And there's this argument goes back at least to the Talmud. And that is whether it's physical resurrection or spiritual immortality. And so let's talk about the difference between those. So physical resurrection is exactly what it sounds like. It'll be a physical rebirth in our bodies, in a purified Jerusalem. We're going to, like, literally, according to some Jewish commentary, we will wake up in the clothes that we were buried in a, you know, in our body has been restored and cured. We will be, like, back in our prime. That is a physical resurrection. Spiritual immortality, on the other hand, our bodies are dead. They have decomposed. We have gone off to heaven to sit next to God. Maimonides talks about this a lot in his writings. I'm going to paraphrase him a little bit. I don't know that he'd like the way I'm paraphrasing him, but we'd be glowy, kind of glowy intelligences basking in God's glory. I don't know that Maimonides would like the phrase glowy intelligences, but that's his idea of what would happen next. And by the way, it was really kind of interesting when Maimonides wrote about Jews dying and becoming glowy intelligences basking in God's glory. He got a lot of flack from the Jewish community and had to write this whole second document where he says, "What? You mean you thought that I meant that we wouldn't be physically resurrected? Ah, you misunderstood. We're totally going to be physically resurrected, just the way the Lord says. And then we're going to almost immediately die again and then become glowy intelligences." So, you know, even Maimonides had to worry about his congregation not being so okay. Like, today's rabbis who have to kind of worry that they don't make their congregations too mad. Yeah, that goes all the way back. Even Maimonides had to deal with that. So when we say that physical resurrection begins in Jerusalem, what we're saying is that when you die, you're going to basically claw your way out of the grave, I guess, or its grave is going to open, and you'll be standing there, a real person. And according to the lore, that starts in Jerusalem. Well, that's going to be a lot of people. That's for problem number one, is that's a lot of people. And the rabbis anticipated this issue of there being more Jews in the future than there was room. And they're like, clearly Jerusalem is going to have to be bigger. They talked about, you know, it'll be like three times bigger, maybe 30 or 300 times bigger. Like, they didn't really anticipate the population of the world, but it's going to make Jerusalem pretty cramped. So they imagine it becoming a lot bigger. The other problem that it raises is that our forefathers and foremothers, Abraham and Sarah and the rest, are buried in the cave of Machpelah outside of Jerusalem. Excuse me. So Why would it start in Jerusalem if some of the most important people in Judaism are not buried in Jerusalem? So the rabbis have an answer for that. And the answer is clearly, you want all of us schlubs to be resurrected first so that we can applaud and cheer when when Abraham and Sarah and Jacob and Isaac and Leah and Rachel, and they all come walking in. You know, they come into thunderous applause of all of their grandchildren and great-grandchildren. That's much better. So that's their explanation, is it gives time for the descendants to be ready to greet them when they walk into Jerusalem. Now, there's another problem, and that is the diaspora, right? Not everybody lives in Jerusalem, and despite the best efforts of Jews who have tried, not everybody can either die in Jerusalem or have their body shipped to Jerusalem. So what about us? What about my dad, who is buried in a graveyard in Connecticut? And what about me? I'm a healthy guy. I'm going to hopefully live a little bit longer, but I will not be buried in Jerusalem. I'm going to be buried in Michigan. At least that's my expectation. The rabbis anticipated this issue. And the answer, and by the way, this is one of my absolute favorite bits of Jewish lore, absolute favorite bit, tunnels. I feel like aliens. The answer is not aliens. The answer is tunnels. There will be tunnels from where you are buried, from your graveyard to Jerusalem, and you will roll to Jerusalem and eventually be physically resurrected in Jerusalem. And not only are you going to roll, but like, this is an ordeal. This will not be fun. And your body will have not been resurrected yet. So just imagine like your skeleton going and everybody else's skeleton kind of going, bumping around through these tunnels, banging over rocks, getting whipped by demons and angels, the whole deal. And it will be absolute suffering all the way through. But then you get there and like, you know, it's all good. All good at that point. By the way, again, sorry for people who are like listening to this and not seeing this, but I love this bit of lore. Excuse me, I love this bit of lore so much that I went and made a subway tunnel version of how I think everyone's going to get to Jerusalem. And if you go to my website, jewishmonsterhunting.com, you can see on one of my previous blog posts, you can see that subway map and download a version from it. It's pretty fun to kind of trace where all the Jews will live, even if you don't necessarily agree with my assertion about how those tunnels would go. It's kind of a fun thing. Okay, so there's another problem though, and that next problem is, by the time all of this happens, you know, we're gonna have, our bodies are gonna be decomposed, right? There's, you know, eventually there's not really anything left, right? Well, not according to the rabbis. According to the rabbis, there is a bone called Luz. This bone is about the size of an acorn. It's usually described as being down at the base of your spine, kind of by your coccyx, though there's some versions that place it at the bottom of, at the top of your spine, at the bottom of your skull. And this bone cannot be burned. It will not disintegrate. It cannot be crushed. That this bone, it just will not rot. And it is this little bone that's going to be the thing that we all are resurrected from. Now, if there are any forensic anthropologists who are listening to this, yeah, not so sure that it works that way. But again, this is the story of how all of that works, that we are going to be resurrected. Those of us who don't have bodies left, who don't have skeletons left, we will at least have this bone. Now, a little interesting side bit, the idea of Luz being associated with immortality, there's another Jewish story about this. There's a city called Luz as well. This city is referenced in the Torah. The city is at Beth El, where Jacob had his dream of climbing a ladder with angels ascending and descending, you know, which is one of the great stories of Genesis. Luz is a city of immortality. It's hidden behind a hollow almond tree. It's almost impossible to find, but once you enter the city, you will live forever up until the point where you decide you no longer wish to live forever. And then if you were to leave the city, you will then, the years will catch up on you and you will die. And so, first of all, it's a great piece of Jewish lore that not everybody knows about, but I just love this image of immortality, the rabbi's understanding that immortality isn't necessarily a good thing when the rest of the world has passed you by and it's just you and a bunch of other immortals in a city, that for some of them, this will become too much and they will decide that they have had enough of life and they have the option of going out and letting the years catch up with them. And part of this lore is that King David is said to live there today, very King Arthur-like, though this story is older than the story of King Arthur. Okay, so let's get back to spiritual immortality. That's all like the messy body skull rolling through tunnels version. What about this glowing intelligence version that Maimonides was so excited about? Where do they go? Like, where are these glowing intentions? And the answer is the Guf, the treasury of souls. So the story of the Guf is that in heaven, where God is, there are different storehouses. One of those storehouses is the storehouse of souls. This is where, before we are born, our soul resides. When we are born, Gabriel plucks it out, gives it to the angel Lila, who then brings it to us. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard the story, or at least some people have heard this, the great Jewish story about how we are taught Torah before we are born, and then just as we're born, an angel taps our lips or spanks us, and we wake up forget having forgotten and having known that we're forgotten. That's why we cry when we wake up, right? That is the angel Lila who does that. And it's worth noting that when we talk about angels, most of the time angels are understood either to be male or to be non-gender specific, though by that we usually mean male. Right, as this kind of the rabbinic default. Lila is one of the few angels who is always described as being female, so, which is kind of cool, bit that a lot of people don't know. That so Lila is the carrier of your soul from the goof to your body. She is also the carrier of your soul from your grave back up to the goof to be stored for later. For when the time to be a glowing intelligence by sitting at God's knee, asking in his glory, when that happens, which isn't necessarily immediately. So Lila plays this kind of role of life giver, but also of psychopomp. Psychopomp is a kind of a general term for someone who escorts you after death. Other cultures have other kinds of psychopomps. Okay. So that's a short version, one version of what happens to us after we die, and particularly anchored around that question. So why do Jews want to go to Jerusalem, or why do Jews want to be buried in Jerusalem? Here's another question. Now, the first two questions are kind of pretty common questions that many people listening to this may have either thought of or heard about. Here's a question that I get all the time. I'm guessing that most people don't get this, but I get this all the time. And that is, are there Jewish exorcisms? Like, hey, if there are Jewish bodies and Jews live like we have some kind of a spiritual life after we die, like, is possession a thing? Do we get all the Amityville Horror here? And the answer is yeah, like, totally. Like, Judaism has this huge lore around possession and exorcisms. So let's jump into that really quick. To get there, the first thing we have to introduce is another idea of what happens after we die. So we talked about, you know, physical resurrection. We talked about spiritual immortality. This is physical reincarnation. Most Jews that I know have not heard of physical reincarnation associated with Judaism. We tend to associate, at least in America, we tend to associate that with some Eastern religions, but it's a very similar idea. And the idea is that the nefesh, kind of the key part of our spirit, has moved after death from our body to a new body. Now, typically, when this happens, and by the way, it doesn't happen to everybody. It doesn't happen to most people. It's only a very narrow group of people will happen to, the both kind of the really holy and also the people who have really screwed up badly enough that they probably can't get into Gehenna or had some issues getting into Gehenna. You were physically reincarnated into a new body, which if it's a human, it's typically a baby. It's a new life. But it also could be an animal or an inanimate object, or in some very special cases, an adult person. So if it's a newborn, you don't know, you don't remember, you just go and live a new life. And hopefully this new life, you will be able to make up for whatever the issues that got you in this position in the first place, or be able to carry on the positive traits that were the reason that you were selected to kind of relive. So if you read some of the Kabbalistic documents, rabbis love to talk about which great sage their rabbi, their teacher was actually a Gilgul of. Gilgul is the term for physical reincarnation. So, this rabbi had to have been a Gilgul for Abraham. This one had to be a Gilgul for Joseph or of some other great rabbi. So there's a lot of, my rabbi's pretty cool. He was a Gilgul of Abraham. It's totally clear. There's a lot of that going on. The whole idea of going into an animal or an inanimate object is always kind of a bit of a punishment. So there's a great Kabbalistic story around this where a Kabbalistic master, I think this was the Ari in Safat in Israel, but I could be wrong on which rabbi it was. But the Ari was known for these kinds of stories where it was explaining there's a cow that kind of wandered into a butcher shop or a place where a shulchan would do the ritual sacrifice, and to explain why the cow would have of its own volition wandered into a place that this was this dangerous, the storyteller, I think it's the RE, said, well, clearly this animal is the gugul of a Jew who did not keep kosher, and so is now repenting of not keeping kosher, and so bringing his physical body to the ritual slaughterer, so he can be slaughtered kosher in a kosher way, and so that other Jews can eat of his body in a kosher fashion. Which to me sounds kind of horrific, actually. I think there's probably a lot of better ways that you could repent of not of eating a cheeseburger than that. But like that's the story, and that's kind of the mindset around it. So, what happens when a Gilgul goes really bad? You end up with a Dybbuk. A Dybbuk is an adult human that has taken possession of another human. It is usually a very wicked person, though not always. Not always. They're not always wicked. And they typically have taken possession of somebody who is at least modestly sinned. And let me assure you, there is no end of the list of the things that might make somebody modestly sinned enough for a Dybbuk to take possession of them. I can't speak for anybody who's listening to this, but I assure you that I do most of them weekly, so I'm a good target for this. And I'm sure all of you are much better Jews, but I am definitely do half of these transgressions, you know, talking about things like not keeping kosher properly, having a mezuzah, but the mezuzah hasn't been checked by a rabbi recently. Having faith, but not having faith in everything. You know, like, you believe that, but you didn't believe this other thing. Things like that. The rabbis could always find an explanation for why a person got targeted for being a Dybbuk. And it's super important that we're talking about this to understand that Dybbuks are a sociological, anthropological, psychological phenomena. We're not just talking about lore in the sense that, the rabbis tell these stories, but it never actually happened. No, Dybbuk possessions happen. They've happened since the 1600s. Now, I want you guys listening to know when I say it happened, I don't know whether real Dybbuks really exist. I don't know whether a real Dybbuk actually took possession of the people. But the people around the person documented that a Dybbuk took possession. Like, it was believed by the community that this was happening. We have hundreds of case studies of Dybbuks going back at least to the 1600s, if not earlier, and they all the way up to the present. There are these stories, and they're usually first, people making these claims, the people around them substantiating the claims. So we have to look at Dybbuks as a very real phenomena, even if it's only psychologically real and not spiritually real. Though I'm sure there are people who will listen to this podcast who are going to be absolutely sure that they're spiritually real, and I'm not the one who's going to argue with you on that point, right? I'm kind of with you on that, but like, we'll let everybody who's listening kind of make their own conclusions. And by the way, if you haven't seen it, there, the black and white Yiddish movie, The Dybbuk from 1937, which is a film adaptation of the play, The Dybbuk, was written by Anski a little bit earlier, is absolutely amazing. It kind of set the tone for at least the modern world's understanding of Dybbuk possession stories. And you should really go find a version. It's incredibly watchable. If you haven't seen it, it's very, very watchable. If you can't find a version that has good good sound and good subtitles, shoot me an email. I can point you to where there is one online. I think it's the Internet Archive is where I saw it, but I'm not 100% sure right now. But hit me up and I can point you there. But it's definitely worth watching. So I want to give an example of a Dybbuk story, and I want to give an example that is relatively current. So we're going to talk of a story from 1994. This is about a young woman named Manuha. She was a Russian immigrant to Israel. She and her family came from Russia to Israel. Her father adopted the family, it basically became part of the Haredi movement. Her father like dove right into it. And worked for a rabbi. He was very, very, became very, very enamored and part of that community, which was great for them. Manuha was very into it as well. Though, as she put in the interviews that were done with her, an academic named Tamara Alexander did a lot of work with her and her family to kind of record these stories. As she put it, her dedication was there, but her faith wasn't always there. She was committed to the life, but she didn't always feel the faith internally. And she took that as a great failing on her point. So the Dybbuk story starts when there was an accident outside of the school, the religious school that Manuha was attending. She went outside and, without realizing it, accidentally stepped in the blood of another young woman who had been killed in a motor vehicle accident. The other girl was a girl named Mary. Her body had been taken away, but her blood was still on the pavement when Manuha got there. And from the moment that she touched the blood, Manuha's claimed that she had pains in her stomach, that she suffered confusion, she would get headaches, that the foot of hers that touched the blood would hurt. And then the worst thing of all happened. She met and fell in love with an IDF soldier. Now, for a young Haredi woman, this was terrible. Young Haredi women were not supposed to even know or talk to soldiers or secular people at all. And, you know, she ended up being shamed in front of her school and sent home to her parents, who were furious. She was yelled at. And then it all came together. She found out that the soldier that she had fallen in love with, and he with her, had a previous girlfriend who had died just before they met, and that his previous girlfriend who died was Miri, whose blood she had stepped in. And then it all clicked for everyone. She had clearly been possessed by the Dybbuk of Miri, who had died in this tragic way. So her father, you know, took her to the rabbi. The rabbi agreed entirely. The rabbi named Daniel, who was a young Kabbalist from Morocco, Moroccan Jewish background, completely agreed that this was a case of a Dybbuk possession. Rabbi Daniel was a wonder rabbi who did exorcisms and other kinds of healings. And so he arranged that they were going to have an exorcism. Now, one thing that's really interesting about this particular story is that right before the exorcism was to happen, Rabbi Daniel was called away for another emergency. So Rabbi Daniel's wife, Dina, actually did the exorcism. So it's just a great case of where the Rebbetzin, the wife of the rabbi, took over and took charge and performed the exorcism. And there's this kind of quote that I'm going to read from Tamara Alexander's paper that she published, which was a quote, which was descriptive of the scene. Manuha was said, and Tamara Alexander quoted her, that we were sitting in the salon when the kitchen faucet began pouring water. I, Manuha, got up to turn it off and heard a loud boom. Then the lights went out, and Dina, the rabbi's wife, said, "Someone is here. A girl. She's sitting in your chair." Manuha sat down in her chair, and Dina said, "Now she's lying in your stomach like a fetus." Dina said, "Who are you? What is your name? What is your mother's name? Get out." And the Gilgul, the spirit of Miri, got up, uncoiled herself, and left. And it was declared a success. Manuha felt much better. She was reaccepted into her family and school. Things were going much better, but it was never complete. She still continued the relationship with the soldier. There were still problems, but at this point, everyone kind of, while nobody liked it, it was kind of understood to be like an after effect of the exorcism. So it gave her a little room to maneuver. So that's an example of exorcism from 1994. There are more recent ones that I could quote there, and there are narratives that go, I said, all the way back to the 1600s, all very well documented. So if you're ever in a position where someone's really acting weird, kind of in the Manuha's acting weird, who knows, maybe it's an exorcism. Definitely go get a qualified rabbi who can go handle the exorcism. This is definitely not a do-it-yourself sort of thing. There's a lot of skills and a lot of knowledge that you would need to be able to do an exorcism. And let me assure you, Jewish exorcisms don't always work. Unlike if you read Catholic exorcism stories, the Catholic priest always works. That is definitely not the case in Jewish stories. There's often a lot of, I tried it. I'm a rabbi. I tried it. It didn't work. I had to go get another rabbi. They finally got it. And I finally took care of it. But if you want to get a sense of what an exorcism is like, and like I said, please don't try this yourself. Here's a list of steps of what a standard exorcism would include. And everyone's a little bit different. So first of all, you need to purify yourself. Fasting, bathing, putting on white clothes, all of this kind of stuff is very good to kind of get your kavana in the right place. Number two, a exorcism is a Jewish service. You need a minion. You need to go gather 10 Jews to be there with you. Typically, the rabbi who's leading the exorcism will interview the Dybbuk. As you heard what Dina was saying, she's asking, you know, who are you? What's your name? What's your mother's name? It's like trying to understand where this Gilgul has come from. And by the way, like one of the jokes among people who are kind of interested in this is that Jewish exorcism is sort of like ghost therapy. In a lot of ways, the purpose of the exorcism, when done well, is to help the Gilgul move on to where it's supposed to go. It's not to punish or hurt the Gilgul or the person who's possessed. It's to encourage them to go. You only kind of get fierce if the Dybbuk doesn't want to let go. So you draw a circle around the person. You will expose the Dybbuk to smoke or sulfur. You will speak to the Dybbuk in its name if you are able to do that. You'll pray. There's a lot of praying going on. Psalm 61 is a very good prayer if you need to do that. You'll try to startle and push the Dybbuk out of the person's body by blowing the shofar, by lighting black candles, by writing and using amulets, by exposing the Dybbuk to a holy Torah scroll or tefillin or lamps. These are all things to kind of help try to nudge it out, push it out of the body. When you do that, at least in traditional exorcisms, you want a bottle for the demon to go into, for the Gilgul to go into, if possible. By the way, there were early examples of possession stories that were not Gilgul, that were more demon-based. When we're talking about bottles, we're really talking about demon exorcisms, which are a little bit different. But, you know, have a bottle handy. Never hurts. And you need to be ready because if you're going to try to capture the Dybbuk, the Dybbuk will exit through a fingernail or toenail or eyes, nose, and mouth, or some other hole in the body that it can get out through. Okay, the last thing I'm going to say about exorcisms, as I said earlier, that they are sociologically, anthropologically, psychologically real phenomena. It is worth noting when we think about that based on the recorded histories of them, about two-thirds of them are women who are claimed or to be possessed or have the claim made for them. And typically, the woman is possessed by a guy. That is not lost on people who study exorcism. There are some really good references I can point people to if they want to read more about that, what the psychology of that is likely to be. No time to get into that right now, but yeah, it's a thing. Hit me up. I can point you to it. Okay. The last thing that I want to mention here before we move on to talking about ghosts is that not all Dybbuks are bad. I mentioned before that a Gilgul can be of a holy person as well. And there's this idea of Ibers. An Iber is a positive Dybbuk, or more importantly, a Dybbuk is a negative Iber. So imagine you're in this situation. I don't expect anybody will find themselves in this situation, but just in case, you are a young rabbi who is studying to be a Kabbalist, and your mentor gives you a homework, and they hand you a shovel. And they take you to the graveyard of a great tzaddik and tell you to dig a trench over the grave of the tzaddik, lie down in it, and spend the night reciting psalms and other prayers. Yeah, that's actually a thing that they would do that. And a goal of this was to acquire knowledge. Hopefully, the rabbi who was laying the trench would be possessed by the spirit of the tzaddik, who would give knowledge and mystical ability, and in the best of case, would follow you and stay with you when you left the graveyard. In some cases, they would just give you knowledge and send you on your way. But ideally, you would actually get them to come with you. And this is described in a lot of Kabbalistic documents. Chaim Vital, who was the student of the great Ari, who was one of the great Kabbalists, wrote a number of books on this phenomena. But there are also Spanish Kabbalists, Moses Cordero, and others who talk about this as well. Okay. Why do we have stones on our graves? Next question that we want to do. We have two questions left. We're getting there. So why do we have stones on our graves? So anyone who's been to a Jewish graveyard will probably observe that there's a tradition of Jews putting stones on the gravestones of other Jews. So where does this come from? Well, first of all, while it's not wrong in the Jewish community to leave flowers, the Talmud actually has a discussion about how and why you might use myrtle in honor of the deceased. Generally, Jews look at placing flowers as not being a very good practice. One, they die very quickly. And the other is that it just feels pagan. It's what everybody else does. So we're not going to do that very well. The more important reason, at least important from the perspective of this talk, is that stones are there to keep our ghosts in the grave where they belong. And yes, 100% Jews believe in ghosts, or at least traditional Judaism has a place for ghosts as part of its lore. And there's a huge amount of religious writing and folktale around the belief in ghosts. Okay. So to kind of understand how that's framed, you need to understand that there's a three-part view of the soul in Judaism. The soul is not just a single unified thing. So first of all, there's the neshama, which we remember I mentioned the neshama we were talking about Sheol earlier, but it's the neshama, which is the really you part. It's Maimonides' glowing intelligence. It's everything that you've learned, experienced, and become. And that is what Lila takes up to the goof, that is what will be present in the world to come. Then there's the nefesh. The nefesh wander is part of your spirit. It's this is the part that ends up in Sheol. Excuse me. The nefesh is the part that would go to Sheol. It's that echo of you. It wanders forlornly back and forth between its home and the grave during the week after the burial, and then departs, but not for long. It could end up back at the grave for a while, but eventually over a year, it'll kind of fade away. And then there's the Ruach, the spirit, which never forsakes the body altogether, but will remain by remain in the grave with the body for forever. This is very specifically a medieval, the three-part discussion I said is very medieval. Joshua Trachtenberg, in his amazing book, Jewish Magic and Superstition from 1939, has this huge discussion of this based on mostly on the Sefer Hasidim, but and on other books from that period as well. An absolutely fascinating breakdown. And the Sefer Hasidim has a bunch of different stories. So first of all, just to understand the Sefer Hasidim, it was a religious text from the late 1100s from German Ashkenaz. This is where the term Ashkenazi Ashkenazi Judaism comes from. Was this very specific place in the German-French border. Eventually, the Ashkenazi Jews moved east into the Pale of Settlement and kept the name Ashkenaz with them, but Ashkenaz was a specific place. So just a couple of examples of Sefer Hasidim ghost stories. So first of all, the ghosts in the graveyard, the Ruha spirits, are gathered nightly by the light of the moon. A spirit council is sometimes called to adjudge disputes between late arrivals and new members, the latest arrivals and older members of the congregation. So there's a sense that, you know, they have this awareness and continuity over time. One of my favorites is that they will often gather wearing their tallit, or if in the case of a woman, not wearing a tallit, but wear have their own services. So, you know, they have a little bit of a life that's happening. I mean, life in the sense of activity that they're going on. One of my favorites is that the ghosts, the Ruha, you know, people hold grudges. Ghosts can hold grudges for a long time. There's a sense you're not supposed to make somebody who's near death angry at you because they might want to kind of get even with you after death. There's a discussion in the Sefer Hasidim about spirits like to be with their friends. You want to put them with people they're going to associate with. If the dead body is someone who thought themselves of a high station, don't bury them with the rest of us riffraff, you know, and vice versa. They won't get away with that. And another one of my favorites is the idea that what you bury the ghost with is part of what it keeps with it in this graveyard afterlife. There's a great classic story about a girl who had a father that was too poor to provide her with the traditional burial shroud. And so she was buried. Her body was just put in the coffin, and that she was unable to go and congregate with the other ghosts because she didn't have appropriate clothing to wear. And so a message was from the ghosts came back to the town that they had to open up the coffin and bury her with a proper shroud so that she could go associate with the other ghosts. So the ghosts have this kind of a life, but you don't want to associate with, you don't want to follow the ghosts. You don't want to be around the ghosts. So you're not supposed to go to the graveyard too often. When you go to the graveyard, when you come home, don't follow a straight line. And if the ghost tries to tell you to come with it, you never come with it because that'll lead to your own death. And one last thing is we tend to think about the term ghost being strictly a protoplasm, some kind of, you know, in the Scooby-Doo sense, something like white sheet that kind of walks through walls. And medieval Jewish lore definitely had that sense of insubstantiability. But there also were physical walking dead. There were examples, and when I told the story of the charcoal man when we started this, he is an example of a revenant, of a physical walking dead. There's nothing about the Akiva story that suggested this person was anyway ghostly. You know, charred a little bit, a little singed, but a human body. And so there's actually a funeral ceremony text from the time period that abjures the body to stay in the grave. Let me just read it because it's wonderful. It says, "In the name of the heavenly court, in the name of the earthly court and the name of the person who died, I conjure you in the name of God of heaven and earth and all his holy names that you, this would be the Ruha, the spirit, will not kill any person bringing it with you, neither man nor woman, neither minor nor adult, neither relative or stranger. Cause them no harm with your body or with your spirit or soul, right? It could be your body that comes out of the grave or your spirit that comes out of the grave. And your body must remain in the grave until the resurrection of the dead. Your soul should remain in its proper place, and likewise, your spirit should remain in its proper place. And this is part of a funeral. This is a funeral ceremony text. I can only imagine including that in a modern handbook on things a rabbi should read. I don't know about you, but if the rabbi, when my father passed away, had included this at the graveside saying, okay, don't forget, you need to stay in the ground. Personally, I would have thought that was awesome. I think everybody else at the funeral probably would have been appalled. My mother would have been absolutely beside herself if that was part of it. But that was part of the traditional Jewish view that the Ruha could come out of the grave. It could bring its body with it, and that could lead to all sorts of problems. Okay, now the last bit about ghosts before we move on to the last section is another one of my favorite things, and that is the beating of the graves. There's this idea in Judaism that when you die, this traditional Judaism, again, not saying that your rabbi would swear by this, but that after you were buried, there was a three-day period, actually it kind of started right before burial, where you would be beaten by an angel who would quiz you. It's sort of like the worst job interview you could possibly imagine, where you're getting quizzed on your life, on the things you've done, but also on elements of your Jewish faith, including what is your Hebrew name. Jews in the diaspora tend to have a secular name and a Hebrew name, or at least a name in the typical language of the community, as well as their Hebrew name. And if you forget that, you are in big trouble. So you definitely don't want to forget what your Jewish name is going to be. This is called Hibut HaKever, the beating of the grain and the grave. And there are all sorts of great and very colorful stories of your body, like being whipped by a demon, whipped by an angel with a chain, and your body blowing into pieces, then coming back together. It's just crazy. And I love it. I love every bit of that story. Not looking forward to that happening to me, but you know, it would make a great movie. Just saying. Anybody out there who wants a great scene from Jewish lore I don't think has ever been shot, that would be the one to go with. Okay. Whew. All right. So we've been at this for a bit. I've got one last topic to talk to everybody about. And it's a simple question. How are we prepared for burial in a traditional Jewish view? We've talked about what's happened after you die. We've talked about spirits and possession and resurrection. But like now, let's just kind of dig into how all that comes together and how we are prepared for burial. So the first thing is there in the traditional Jewish community, there is a Chevra Kedisha. It is the holy society. It is the burial society. In a lot of places, including here where I live in Ann Arbor, we don't have a Chevra Kedisha. The funeral home kind of takes on this role. I personally am sad about that, but there are still a lot of places, particularly in more traditionally minded communities, where Chevra Kedishas exist. And even in the liberal community, there's starting to be more of them. The idea of the Chevra Kedisha is that from the moment the person dies, they are being taken care of by a member of the Jewish community who has been trained and knows what they need to do. They are never left alone. Overnight, psalms are read over them. During the day, their body is prepared for burial. There's a series of practices that go along with that. And we're going to talk about tahara. Tahara is the process of ritually washing and dressing the body. Now, on the slide, and I'm going to read bits of it for people who are listening to this on the podcast, but you can go to my website and grab the slides and see the whole list. I have a list of steps that come from the community Chevra Kedisha from Greater Boston. Like, this was literally cut and paste right off their website when I was putting the slides together. So here are here is the list of things, and I'm going to call attention to a couple of them as we go through. So the first one is that the team, the Chevra Kedisha, prepares the room and the coffin, which is called Aron, the coffin, to perform the Tahara. Soil from Israel is sprinkled in the Aron. So remember we talked about like being wanting to go to Jerusalem, be buried in Jerusalem, and why that was the case. So here that is, right back at us as part of the Tahara process. The soil from Israel is sprinkled in the Aron, and a sheet or shroud and a tallit are placed in the Aron. Remember I said a minute ago, there's the young woman who was buried without her shroud and was not able to have dignity to be able to join with the other ghosts. That story comes from this aspect of Tahara. The next few are more, let's say, prosaic, but just as important spiritually. That the Chevra Kedisha asks for forgiveness for beginning, for anything that they might do that is not correct, that they're going to do their best. That prayers or readings are recited during the Tahara ritual, Psalms in particular. That they will inspect the condition of the body and then perform the initial washing and grooming. There's a set of steps on how you wash the body. You elevate the body off the table using wooden boards so that no part of the body rests on the table. You perform the Tahara ritual by pouring a continuous flow of 3 buckets of water over the body. This is to help, again, help clean the body in preparation. Carefully dry the body and in preparation for dressing. Then you dress the body, starting with the head, covering, pants, shirts, outer shirt, a kittel, ribbons are tied around the ankles. A special knot is used for all of the ties. Now, this specific discussion is what the Chevra Kedisha of Greater Boston does, as it, for dress, other communities might dress slightly differently. Finally, the body is placed in the coffin. Any remaining soil is sprinkled over the body. Then pottery shards are placed on the eyelids. We're going to hold that. We're going to get back to that in a moment. I'll explain what that is. Then the tallit is wrapped around the body, and one tassel is cut off or knotted to make it ritually unfit. Traditionally, a tallit has 4 fringes, and if you cut one or damage one, it would no longer be kosher. So we're buried in an unkosher tallit. And then the tallit is wrapped around the sheet or the shroud. And finally, the wooden cover is placed over their own, and the team asks the body for forgiveness for any inadvertent indiscretions in case we did anything wrong. So that's kind of the basic workflow. And like I said, we talked about the soil from Israel. We talked about what could happen if you don't bury somebody with a shroud. Let's talk about the pottery shards, because that's something we haven't talked to. So the pottery shards are called sharbalech. Sharbalech is symbolic. There's a couple of explanations for these pottery shards. And they literally just sit on your eyes and mouth. They have the Shema. One way to do it is to write the Shema on them, on the 3 pieces. One explanation for it is that it allows us to come in contact with earth while we're being buried. If we're buried in a wooden coffin, we're not touching the earth. And that's not how, according to Jewish funeral practice, you're supposed to touch the earth, so this will help you do that. That's one. Another answer is that the eyes and the mouth are covered by earthenware as a special sign of penitence for having been organs of potential sin. We have said sinful things, we have sinned, we have seen sinful things, and this is a way of showing repentance for that. So that is sharbalech. And by the way, the earthenware pottery for sharbalech is nothing special. I actually made a set of sharbalech recently just by going and getting, I think I went to Home Depot and picked up the kind of the clay pot that you would plant flowers in, you know, like $5 little clay pot, broke it into pieces and wrote the Shema on it. And I talked to somebody I know who's a member of Chevra Kedisha, and he's like, yeah, that's exactly what you do. There's nothing special. What's special is the kavana, the intention of how you do it, and making sure that it's done. The last thing we're going to talk about as part of Tahara, it was not mentioned on the Boston list, but it is mentioned on other lists, is something called a gepalach. It's a resurrection fork. And for folks who are listening who speak Yiddish, my understanding is kapalak really just means a fork. But this is specifically a resurrection fork. It has a set of texts. There would be two of them that would be made. One of them would have a quote from Psalms. Return my soul to your restfulness, for Adonai has rewarded you bountifully. The other one says, and this is a statement from traditional, from the Orthodox liturgy. I don't believe the statement is in, it's certainly not in the Reform liturgy. I don't think it's in the conservative liturgy either. But this would be part of a daily Orthodox prayer that says, I fully believe in the resurrection of the dead. And these two sticks are symbolic of that physical resurrection that we talked about earlier, though don't ask me how exactly they're supposed to work. I have not been able to get a good understanding of what the dead body, like if I were buried with a pair of gepalach, which by the way, would be awesome. I really hope that happens. When the physical resurrection comes, I'm not quite sure what I'm supposed to do with the forks. One place said it's supposed to help you kind of dig your way out. And I don't, that seems inconsistent with other things I've read. So I'm really, really not sure. What I know is that it's a really beautiful statement of faith. And I have a very active Twitter feed. And at one point about a few months ago, I was talking about gepalach and I was showing pictures. I've made a few. I have a little wood workshop. I'm terrible at it, but like, you know, I enjoy it a lot. And I made a couple of gepalach forks and a woman reached out to me who had followed me on Twitter. Her mother at that time had terminal cancer. I'm not sure if she's passed away yet at this point. And when the woman saw my post about this, she showed it to her mother, and the two of them were absolutely enchanted about that. The idea of being buried with this fork that says, I fully believe in the resurrection of the dead. And the two of them reached out to me and asked if it would be possible for me to make a pair for them. So I did. Actually, I think they just asked for one fork. And so I sent them a single fork. My woodworking is not amazing. I asked my daughter who's got much better penmanship than I do, to do the Hebrew. It came out pretty well. But it was something that they treasured. It was kind of very symbolic of that aspect of Jewish faith. And so I can understand really viscerally why that became part of the tradition. And it's kind of a shame that it's not more a part of the tradition, at least I think. I'm obviously a big fan of these very physical and symbolic elements. Okay, so that's it. Let's kind of wrapping this up. We've walked through a lot of different Jewish death lore. We've talked about why Jews are buried, how Jews are buried, like what's the process of the Shevar Kedisha and Tahara. We've talked about ghosts and why we put stones on top of graves. We've talked about exorcisms. We've talked about why Jews want to be buried in Jerusalem. We've talked about why Jews... where did we start? Oh, the Mortar's Kaddish. Like, why did you say the Mortar's Kaddish? So, long set of stuff. Thanks for everyone who stuck with me. Thanks for sticking with me. Like, we could keep going for another 2 hours. There's so much more stuff that I haven't even gotten to. Maybe I'll do a follow-up on this someday to get to some more stuff. But this seemed like the best stuff to talk to. So, just want to say thanks to Michigan Lamud for giving me the opportunity to do the talk. Thanks to everyone who follows me on Twitter and on Blue Sky, who all poked me to do this recording. I hope that anybody who is listening, who finds this interesting, follows me on Twitter or Blue Sky, or listens to the Wayward Children podcast, which I do with John Baltusberger, who's a Jewish horror novelist. And you can find Wayward Children any place that you download your podcasts. And I've currently have this wonderful project going about Jewish monster hunting trading cards, which hopefully we'll be doing a Kickstarter sometime in 2024. So stick with me however you want to stick with me, and you'll get to hear all about it. Thanks, everybody. Good night. Talk to you all later.
Oh my God, Jack. I couldn't get a word in edgewise there.
I know. I just kept going and going, and you're just sitting there waving your arms. I mean, like, if John could have put a flare gun up, like, he was thinking about it. You could clearly see him rooting around.
I did. My house is burning down now. It's awful. Fascinating stuff. I think it's funny. I think the problem with this format now is that people are going to realize that I'm redundant and unnecessary for the show. But
No, that's
here we are. I
that's
hope
so not
y'all.
true.
I
No,
hope
seriously.
y'all.
So I have to say this. So when John and I first started talking about this, we had this kind of idea that, like, okay, Jack represents the lore, John represents fiction, horror, games, and like it would be a culture critique as much as anything else. And anybody who's listening, that's not quite what's happened. What's actually you've found out is that Jack is the nerd. And John has a deep soul and really wants to share kind of like his personal views of Judaism way better than I could ever articulate. So, John, you are the soul of the show. Like, I'm the researcher, but you are the soul of the show with no question about it.
It's funny that no one ever describes me as not being the nerd at
No,
any
no.
point. As I look deeply at my Castlevania and Godzilla tattoos. So hey, do you have anything to recommend after that talk? Any books
Yeah,
or
absolutely. So in the slides, in the notes at the end of the slides, there's about seven books that I recommend. But for now, let me just say that there are two books that I think people should really think about reading if they've enjoyed that talk at all. One is a book called Jewish Views of the Afterlife by Simcha Paul-Raphael. And Raphael runs the whole history. He doesn't get into a lot of like the nerdy medieval lore in the way that I kind of love to jump into it. But if you want to sit down and read a serious Jewish take on what happens after we die, Simcha Paul-Raphael's Jewish Views of the Afterlife is absolutely the book to start with. The second book I want to recommend is kind of a ringer. It's a book called The Tahara Manual of Practice by Rabbi Moshe Epstein. If you just listen to the talk, you know what Tahara is. Tahara is the ritual practice that the Chevra Kedisha, the burial society, goes through to wash and clean the corpse. And if you read this, it's a hodgepodge of local minhag, local customs and traditions, with a lot of halakha, a lot of legal rulings on why it is that way. And it is absolutely fascinating. And let me assure you, the book was not written for you. And it was not written for me. The book was written for Chevra Kedisha members who want to understand what they're doing and why, which makes it a little bit esoteric at times, but it is a fascinating, fascinating read if you want to get a look into that world. So those are the two books that I want to recommend, John.
who would have ever thought that we would recommend something esoteric?
I mean, it's completely out of character. Completely out
There's
of
a book I
character.
want to recommend, but I'm going to recommend a different book instead.
Yeah.
Today I'm going to recommend The Soul of the Matter by Gershon Winkler.
Oh, good one.
The subtitle for that is A Jewish Kabbalistic Perspective on the Human Soul Before, During, and After Life. I adore Gershon Winkler, and what one of the things that makes him a really interesting read is about 60% of his books were written when he was an ultra-Orthodox Hasid living in like New York, I think, in Brooklyn, and kind of living life as a ultra-Orthodox Kabbalist. And the other like 40% of his books were written after he kind of fell away from that community and became this like weird forefathers of renewal Judaism along with Rabbi Zalman Schechter and so he went from being very ultra orthodox to ultra flexidox in his own terms. But incredibly knowledgeable and extremely good writing that just very easy to understand, very approachable. There's another book. I'm going to recommend another Gershon Winkler book. I don't care. I'm going to
Do
do
it,
it.
do it.
This one is not, this is less apropos, but he wrote a book called The Judeo-Christian Fiction. It's basically a book examining the idea that that many people outside of Judaism has, that Judaism is just Christianity beta version. and kind of addresses that they are not the same religion, that they're not the same faith, and that they're not, they should not be lumped together, especially when people are, you know, oftentimes when people are complaining about the Christian right and kind of draconian, especially in America anyway, Christian laws. They like, oh, I don't need to do this Judeo-Christian stuff. And like all the Jews around are like, I had nothing to do with this.
Yeah. Why are you looking at me, guys? We hate that stuff too.
We don't do some of these things, but we don't care if you do. So, it's a fantastic book. Highly recommend it. Gershon Winker kicks my butt, but those are the two books for my recommendation today. Hey, Jack, do you have a thank you to someone?
I do.
Who do you want to thank?
Well, I want to thank Yoshi Fruchter, as we always do. Yoshi's got this amazing band, Potomac, and one of their songs, Skin and Bones, is our intro and outro music. Want to point you to them. And as I've said before, Potomac's an amazing band, and Yoshi also has a new band called Sandcatchers. Equally good, very different vibe. Totally got to check it out.
Absolutely. Awesome stuff. And Sandcatchers is such a good name for a band. Absolutely. Next time I'm just going to recommend non-Jewish bands that I like from and I like this band. And friends, thank you so much for joining Jack on this episode of Wayward Children. I am the static you hear in your headphone as you're trying to listen to other people talk, John Baltusberger.
I am Jack Zions, the shovel full of dirt landing on your coffin. See, you always have like better ones than I do. I'm always like, damn, I wish I had said that.
We will return in a couple of weeks. Our ending advice, as always, is stay out of the ruins.
Stay out of the ruins.
Just out of them ruins.